My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Strout to KBOO into Portland. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Do I call you Elizabeth, Liz? Liz? Liz is good.
Great.
Okay. Title of your book is Olive Kittredge, and it's published by Random House. And I said book instead of novel because the first question I'm going to ask you is this a book of short stories with a unifying theme, or is it a novel told in short stories?
I really think it's a novel told in short stories.
When you conceived of the book, did it pop into your mind like that, or did what was the genesis?
I always thought that I would write Olive's story in this particular form, which is essentially 13 tales, 13 stories or chapters. They are separate. They will stand up on their own. But I always perceived Olive's story to be written in that form.
Mm-hmm. Olive is it takes place in Crosby, Maine,
right.
Which if anybody remembers Murder, She Wrote, the town of Cabot Cove had the highest murder rate in the world for a town of that size, I would say, right? Because there was at least one corpse every week in this little tiny town. When I read about Crosby, Maine, I thought, well, here's a town full of passion, neurosis, and schadenfreude. Does that pretty much describe it?
Well, yes. I think it's a town full of people, so it pretty much describes it, I think.
That was the second thing I thought. You know, it's just like
it's
everywhere
everybody.
Else. Yeah.
Right.
Olive is a retired math teacher, and she's I don't know how to say this because her character evolves like all good characters do in the course of a novel, but she's very hard. She's a tough, strong, no-nonsense kind of a
Absolutely.
Woman.
Absolutely.
And I thought, well, why a math teacher? Because when you're a math teacher, there's only one right answer, and she has it.
That's right.
She's not an English teacher
she's
or history
teacher.
She's
not an English teacher. She's not open to a lot of interpretations, although she is very intuitive and in many ways. But yes, it's the math. It's this equals this, and you know, that sort of thing. But she is a great force on the page, which is back to why I wrote it this way, because I thought that she's such a strong force on the page. I thought the reader needs a break in between, or needs to see her from a different point of view every so often.
I think that's true. She's so strong that mm-hmm. You can come to resent her. And I think
right.
during parts of the book you do come to resent
exactly.
her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then I want a whole nother perspective through somebody else's eyes to come in, and we see her vulnerabilities mm-hmm. as well.
So. You've manipulated me quite well in this book, actually. I've done exactly what you wanted me to do.
Oh, good. That's good. Love it.
So here we are in Crosby, Maine. Olive has a husband named Henry.
Yes.
Who is, if not a polar opposite of Olive, certainly not the sort of person you think would become involved with her, or she would become involved with as a man.
She's been very lucky
yes.
to find a steadfast, very
Tell us about
decent.
Henry.
He's a very, very steadfast, rather quiet, very compassionate, kind man. He is her anchor, I think, is a way, you know, that one would assume, or I assumed in imagining them, that in their younger years he would have been attracted to her energy and that she would have been attracted to his decency, sort of counteracting their
Do each
points.
Of them keep the other from flying off tangentially in some bad direction?
I think so. I definitely think that Henry keeps Olive from doing, you know, destruction. Although she obviously has, toward the end of the book, I hope are somewhat surprised by how she can manage and move toward a much more loving kind of outlook. But I think, yes, I think that in that way they're a very good couple. They do keep each other safe from themselves.
Yeah, they have a son named Christopher.
Yes.
Christopher was more of a mama's boy than a daddy's boy,
mm-hmm.
but it was through main force,
exactly.
maybe rather than personal inclination.
Exactly.
Yes?
Very possessive mother. There are little clues of why this might be the case, but I wasn't interested too much in the whys, as much as understanding that these things do happen. There are mothers that are very overbearing, and their sons have to find ways to deal with it, and that was what was interesting to me.
I was wondering, there's a lot of rage in this book.
Yes.
It pops up in different ways and in different characters. There's a lot of characters in the book because it has 13 short stories.
Right.
More so than you might think for a small town novel. You know what I'm getting at,
yes.
right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What's the source of the rage, do you think? Why are people so thwarted and so angry about it?
Well, I'm always interested in time and place, and this is This is a small town in coastal Maine. It's a time and a place that's disappearing very quickly. It still exists, obviously, these small towns, but they are changing as the whole country is changing. This is sort of the last moment, I think, that we'll see towns like this in a certain way, and their identity is very much embedded in the geography of the land. Their ancestors have been there for a long time. And yet there's a sense that maybe the world is looking down on them, or maybe they're isolated. They are isolated. So I think that there is a certain kind of defensiveness, and that it's unconscious. And yet you've got somebody like Olive, who's a very intelligent woman, and her options are somewhat limited to really make use of her large energies and capacities. And so I think there's that sort of thing that is going on there.
And yet she would never think of leaving. I mean,
no.
At some point somebody actually suggests it, and she dismisses
Absolutely
it as though it's the stupidest
not.
Thing in the world.
Absolutely not. She is tied to that land like a barnacle to the rock. That is who she is. That is her identity. And that interested me as well, because I do think that this is, like I said, it's changing. America is changing very, very fast. And these are sort of the last glimpses of people who have for 10, 12 generations lived in one spot.
I remember reading not too long ago, this year sometime, about an island off the coast of Maine whose ferry went down, and it was the only source of connection between the mainland and this island, and it caused them some grief because they weren't able to get supplies and,
exactly.
you know, they weren't able to commute to their jobs and things like that. And I thought, Crosby, Maine is really almost as isolated as this island is.
It is.
Psychologically and through the force of their personality.
Exactly. I think that's absolutely true. I am very interested in what isolation, the geography of the isolation and the isolation of the personalities that result when they're not leaving, they're not going too far away to work, they're not going too far away to vacation because they live in one of the most beautiful spots in the world. And
too cold in the winter, though.
Too cold in the winter.
Yep.
Yep.
Another thing I was thinking, this didn't occur to me as I was reading the book, but as I was rethinking this thing for the interview, is that, am I incorrect in assuming that there's a lot of satire of modern American life in this book, that you're using this book to poke fun at some of the things we think and believe nowadays?
I don't think of myself as using my work to poke fun. So I think that those wouldn't be words that I would choose, because I go very seriously to the page, and my characters are very much straight from my heart. So I don't think that I would use that term, poking fun, at all. But I do think that we are living with certain aspects. There's, look what her son leaves, and you know, just the whole kind of email exchange and what therapy does to a family like that. And so I don't know that I'm poking fun. And then there's the parrot who recites this, praise God. And
I have to say that was the funniest thing in the book.
Right.
I
do mean to have fun. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to give the impression that it's all serious, but no, I do mean to have a great deal of fun, mm-hmm. With these details that, you know, sort of come my way through my imagination. So, so I'm certainly trying to record what's happening.
So you're not an active satirist. You're at best
no.
a passive satirist.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got that out of the way. One of the things that happens early on in the book is that Olive is poking around town doing something. There's that word poking again. She's walking mm-hmm. around town busy with something, and she thinks she sees one of her old students sitting in a car mm-hmm. by himself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say too much about this because I don't
right.
want to screw around with, you know,
right.
giving it away.
Very
but I would like you to
story.
Yeah, I would like you to tell us a little bit about it and going as far as you would like to go.
I like that. Well, I like all my stories, quite honestly, but I like
they're
that
all
story.
Your children,
that,
aren't
yeah, they?
They
are. They absolutely are, and I care very deeply about them, and I feel that they can be cared for by others. But that story in particular is one that was very special for me to write, and I love that image of Olive intuitively understanding, and also just being herself. She just enters that fellow's car, and she's just herself, and in being herself changes a life.
Well, I just want to quote one line from that particular chapter. Hope was a cancer inside him. Tell me about that.
Well, this is a fellow who is, he's at a point at that point in the story where he no longer wants hope. His own background and what has caused him to come back home to this town has been so difficult that he doesn't want to experience the tensions that hope can bring.
Olive is sometimes gets a little bit of pleasure in squelching other people's happiness, but in this case, that's not it at all.
No, she's quite understanding of him for reasons that are there in the story. But I think it shows her at her very best.
I agree. It would show anybody at the very best. This was an opportunity to rise above everything and
absolutely.
Do the right thing, and she took it.
She absolutely did. Absolutely.
And it's one of the reasons you don't wind up, you know, saying, oh, my God, I don't want to read any more about this woman, and, you know, throwing the book aside.
Because I think she's quite compelling.
You drop little hints through the whole book, don't you?
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
Yeah. And then there's a surprise ending, which I won't give away, but right. I was amazed at the ending of the book. We'll talk a little bit about that. There seem to be a lot of loveless marriages and loveless affairs going on in Crosby, Maine. People going through the motions in both their marriages and going through the motions even with the people they're having sneaky little affairs with. Daisy and Harmon?
Right.
Yes.
But their friendship, so to speak, does actually turn into quite a deep love affair. And Olive and Henry have a lot of love in their marriage,
yes.
I think.
Well, Henry is the saintly, certainly the most.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she loves him. She loves him in her way, to the best of her ability. And Harmon's situation is really sort of an empty nest situation seen from a man's point of view, who, you know, has those four sons, and is saddened by the emptying of his house. And it's almost more that than the state of his marriage, I think, that makes him yearn for more life.
There's a character in that story named Nina,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a young, anorexic, and very screwed up girl.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's in her early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
She weighs about 11 pounds, and she hangs out with all the wrong people.
Right.
And she winds up touching Harmon in a way that he didn't even know. She winds up touching Olive
exactly.
in a way that she didn't even know
exactly.
she could be touched.
And that was also one of those moments where Olive comes into her life, and we see Olive very vulnerable and very, frankly, loving. And I really enjoyed writing that scene where Olive says, I'm starving too. And because we understand then that in there, you know, we all are. We're all starving for something, I think, and, you know, love and safety and hope and all those things. So, yes, she does. She ends up touching a lot of people in that town.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, I guess the Harmon and Daisy relationship coalesces around everybody.
That's right.
Worrying about
that's
Nina.
Right. That's right. So there's always love available in whatever form it may find itself.
Got love if you want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Stroud. Elizabeth is the author of Olive Kitteridge, published by Random House. There's a the things that happen to Olive, they're off somewhere, and she needs to use the bathroom
mm-hmm.
pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's on the verge of dissolving.
Yeah.
And Henry says, well, there's the hospital. They'll let you use the bathroom. Can you tell us what happens there? I don't want to give too much of that away.
Well, that was also a very fun story to write, even though it takes a turn, which is kind of intense, I guess, by the time the story gets finished, what's been revealed to Olive and Henry about themselves. But essentially, they've had a wonderful evening with friends, and she's eaten a little too much, and she's all of a sudden in great need of a bathroom, and they stop in to use the bathroom in this hospital and end up in a situation being held hostage. And I read a great deal about different hostage situations, and it was fascinating, and to make that story the story that it became.
Yeah, the two young men that hold people in the hospital hostage mm-hmm. are incompetent at what they're doing and terrified.
Exactly.
And they're maybe even more scared than the people that they're holding.
Exactly. Exactly.
The hospital is also, it's one of those, I mean, you know, if you're going to do this, it's a prefiguring of what's going to happen. Because, and again, I don't want to give too much away, but when Henry is taken from Olive, he's not taken all at once, is he?
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell us about that.
Well, he's does have a stroke, and he remains, in essence, his decent self. And I thought that was important, that when she goes, and she's very loyal, and she goes twice a day and feeds him and believes that he can hear her, and he always has that slight smile on his face, even though there's some controversy about whether or not he actually can understand her. She believes that he can, and she goes there, and a friend says, "Oh, you're a saint," and she says, "No, I'm not a saint, because Olive is never going to be called a saint," mm-hmm. and she knows that about herself, but she is a fiercely loyal person, and she is loyal to Henry.
Yeah, and this is something, of course, many of us are having to deal with, or will have to deal with, is the slow decline
yes.
of a loved one. And
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she comes through again.
She does.
Yeah.
She does.
She has a lot of character. It's just that she tries to keep it hidden as much as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. She's far more complicated than she appears.
The idea of, it's an old idea that people put up walls to hide their real selves. You know, she's in Maine, so she's like a lobster.
Yeah.
Where everything's under a hard shell.
That's right.
But there is some sweet meat underneath, isn't
there? There is some very sweet meat. And I think that it gives the reader a chance to understand that so much of what is experienced in a negative way really comes from fear for all of us.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I want to talk a little bit about Christopher, because
yes.
Christopher, when I was thinking of this book was satire, I thought Christopher is your tool for, it's your satirical tool. The first thing he does is marry a Jewish woman,
mm-hmm.
and believe me, it's not way overplayed in this book, but there is a slight whiff of anti-Semitism.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Just a slight whiff, though.
Right.
Yeah, tell us about Suzanne.
Well, she's she just irritates Olive profoundly. Of course. Of course. I mean, Olive has adored her son. She's planned on her son living next door. Not next door, but close by. She and her husband have built a house for him, a beautiful house. And he marries a woman who, surprise, surprise, is also a force to be contended with. And she irritates Olive very much. She's a doctor. She thinks she knows a great deal. She probably does know a great deal. But she doesn't know much about flowers and plants and the things that Olive, holds very dear to her heart.
She's a city kid.
She's a city kid. Exactly. So not only did he marry outside the New England background that he came from for so many generations, but he married culturally somebody quite different, and it's very frightening to Olive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they move and
they move. She,
yeah.
The new wife moves him out to California.
There's another little thing I want to bring up. You notice I only have two little yellow post-it notes here. Olive decides she's going to disrupt Dr. Sue's life.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Tell us about that.
Yes, many people have spoken to me about that particular scene on Christopher's wedding day, and the wedding reception is at this house, the beautiful house that she and Henry have built for Christopher. And she does decide, after overhearing the fact that her daughter-in-law has made fun of her dress, and Olive has made the dress, and it is very painful. And she does decide that she'll just take from the drawer in the bedroom a bra and a shoe, I believe, from the closet, and kind of upset Suzanne's equilibrium when Suzanne starts to wonder, where did that shoe go or where did that bra go?
Just to put a little doubt.
Just to put a little doubt in Suzanne's all-knowing mind.
That's,
so it's funny, but it's
yeah,
sad.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
A practical joke that comes from somewhere deep inside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I've had people really rooting for Olive, cheering her on for this bizarre situation.
Well, poor Dr. Sue is just Dr. Sue.
Dr. Sue. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
exactly.
It's not like she's fooling
no.
anybody.
No.
So,
she's
yeah.
not.
When And again, if I try too heavily on things you don't want to talk about here, just let me know. But
I'll talk about anything.
They moved to California.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, California is what, according to Olive?
Well, that's just, you might as well be moving to Southeast Asia to go from New England and all the generations that precede them to go to California is a terrible slap in her face, not only because the new wife has essentially won him, but because it's an entirely different culture out there, and it's just a huge loss, a huge unspeakable loss for both Olive and Henry, but of course particularly for Olive.
Also, Olive sees California as a petri dish upon which something horrible and culturally obnoxious grows all the time.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And she thinks that Christopher has become a victim of this.
That's right. That's right. She feels very much that she's lost him. And then, of course, he does end up in New York City, which is even more bizarre.
But closer.
Exactly.
That's really funny because Olive barely understands Boston.
That's right.
And New York is terra incognita completely.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And she really has no interest in it at all except for her response to 9/11. She was very moved by that. And, of course, and by the fact that those hijackers came through Portland, Maine, which is near where she is. But she braves it and goes to New York when she's called upon to visit her son. And, of course, that's
the new wife.
Quite a story.
Right? Yeah. Right. In fact, during the visit, it's what, the first anniversary of Christopher's second marriage?
Right.
And Olive is annoyed because she didn't even know
That's right. It's clear that there has been a real rupture between Christopher and his mother that he's now trying to mend, and she's willing to mend it. But you know, these things aren't easy.
This is where we run into the parrot.
Yes. The parrot, that's right.
They have Anne is the new wife,
right.
And she is pregnant.
Right.
And she already has a couple of rugrats
children
running around.
Right, right.
And she's an earth mother.
Yes, she's sort of the opposite of Dr. Seuss. She's sort of all embracing, you know, she's very open-hearted. And
she's the opposite in many ways of Olive as well.
Yes,
but,
exactly.
But whereas Dr. Sue is the opposite in one direction,
right.
She's the opposite in the other direction.
Exactly, exactly. So Christopher has gone from
one extreme to the other.
Yeah. Right.
She's fun. I like Anne a lot. She
yeah.
insists on calling Olive mother.
That's right. That's right.
She just wants to love everybody.
She does. Yeah. She's a good-hearted person.
And they have a tenant upstairs.
Mm-hmm. Upstairs.
Who is a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And whose name may or may not be Sean O'Casey.
Right.
Who has a parrot who provides like a Greek chorus
That's
function.
That's right. That's
tell,
right.
Tell us about the parrot. Well, I want you to tell
the
us.
Well, the parrot, which amazes Olive on many different levels, and when she's sitting out in the back patch of cement, which they call a garden, but the parrot, every time the parrot hears a swear word, will say either praise God or God is king or something along those
yeah.
lines, and it shrieks this out every time somebody swears down below.
This to me is a metaphor for a certain mindset that
yes,
I really,
yeah. Yes, yes, exactly. It's like at the time, you know, I just wrote it because it came to me, and then I realized, wait a minute, this is even better than I thought.
I don't want to get into it too deeply again, but something redeeming happens to Olive at the end of the book,
yes.
which is extremely surprising to
That's
me.
Right.
Because I didn't think, not that I didn't think she was capable of it, but I didn't think she would have had the opportunity.
Right.
Tell us whatever you want to tell us about that.
Well, she is, she has lost a great deal, as we do as we get older. The losses accumulate, and by the end of the book, she's alone and she's frightened, and yet she is compassionate enough to understand that state of being in another, and she realizes that she's been given a chance to join life again or to stay on the outside, and she chooses to engage in life and in love, and it is there. It's always been a possibility of Olive, because that's what we've seen in her many different aspects. But the fact that she does decide to go with that one was I was glad.
One of the little modern truisms that's popped up in the last few years is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yes.
And I think that's exactly what happens to Olive,
isn't
it?
That's right. That's a very good point. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
She begins to find, instead of just looking at everything askance and finding only the things that irk her.
That's right.
She gets past that.
She has been a very judgmental woman. And here at one of the, you know, hopefully not last hours, but close to one of the last hours as she's progressed through her life, she is able to understand that about herself and to choose to let it go.
I mentioned Sean O'Casey before, who also happens to be the name of an Irish playwright. I don't know if you did that purposely, out of homage, but that reminds her, we only have a couple of minutes, but that reminds her of a man named Jim O'Casey.
That's right.
And I wanted to get into that. Give us just a little bit of that.
Well, she did, in her marriage, have feelings for somebody else, and they were quite intense. She never acted on them because she had thought perhaps she would, but she didn't. And I think that Olive wouldn't. So I think that even though in her memory she looks back and thinks, well, I wonder if I really would have done that, the opportunity was taken away from her before she had a chance to act on it. I don't think she would have acted on it. And yet, I think that there are many people over the course of long marriages who've had different friendships that are unspoken in terms of the intensity of them, but they have these moments in their lives or these periods in their lives where they're very drawn to somebody else, mm-hmm. because they feel, as Olive felt, that she'd been seen. She felt that this Jim saw her for who she really was. And of course, Henry sees her for who she really is too. But at that time in her life, she was feeling not particularly seen.
We all respond to being appreciated, don't
yes,
we?
We do. That's exactly it, of course. We all want to be seen.
Well, one last question. Would you go out and have a beer with Olive Kittredge?
I would have a beer with Olive Kittredge. I'm not sure she'd have a beer, but I think she should.
Oh, I agree completely.
I think this woman should have a beer.
Yeah, so
and I would be happy
to loosen her up a little bit.
To loosen her up and have a beer with her, absolutely.
This has been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Stroud. Elizabeth is the author of Olive Kittredge, published by Random House. Please come back again.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.